Well, I left off. I got through four, right? I didn't say anything about five yet. Okay. In slide five, we're looking at a lie, two lies. Neither one of these things is the truth about how an atom really is. But the one on the right is even more of a lie. This is the so-called planetary model, because the electrons are shown orbiting in a defined path around the nucleus. That doesn't really happen. But it's actually good to have that model in your mind, even though it's not real. The one on the left is a little bit closer to the truth. It's still kind of a lie. But notice there's no electrons shown here distinctly. Instead, this yellowish space around the nucleus is where the electrons are found. It's actually impossible to predict at any given moment where they are exactly. And that's why it's drawn as just a probability space, meaning that the electrons are here somewhere, and the darker the yellow color, the more probable they're there, but we just don't know. So it's probably better just to think of it in terms of the planetary model in your head, even though neither one of them is strictly the truth. That's beyond the scope of this course, though. Let's go on to six. And here we're looking at an atom. The atomic nucleus is just generically drawn here. There's however many protons and neutrons. It doesn't matter. The point is that the space outside the nucleus, which is where the electrons are found, is not a structure, of course. It's just a space. But it has subdivisions. In other words, subspaces making up that space. The major subdivisions of that space are called energy levels, which can also be called shells. An electron shell and an energy level, atomic energy level, mean the same thing. You can use those terms interchangeably. But they are just parts of this space around the atomic nucleus where electrons can occur. What's important to know in this course about energy levels is that electrons are always occupying a certain energy level or another energy level. They're never between energy levels. They can move between energy levels, but they are in one or the other. By analogy with this ball that's bouncing down the stairs. You can try this as many times as you want, and the ball will land somewhere on a step. It will never land between steps. Right? It might go all the way down, it might land on a certain step, but it's never going to be between two steps. Similarly, any given electron is in one energy level or shell or another. And energy levels or shells are arranged by their distance from the nucleus. And they are not equal in terms of energy. The lowest energy level is the one that's closest to the nucleus. And that's where electrons will be found if they're able to occupy that, because that's the most stable situation. The lowest energy level is the most stable. The problem is, from the viewpoint of an individual electron, is that it might not be able to occupy the lowest energy level because there might already be electrons there. And so these are subspaces, like I said. The shells do not have structure. They're not made of matter, I mean. They're just spaces. But they can only contain a certain maximum number of electrons. All right? More about this in a minute with a different slide. But what we see here with the arrows on this diagram is that electrons can actually jump up one or more energy levels or shells. If they do, that requires energy for that to happen. And that will be a more unstable situation. The electrons would like to go back down to the lower energy level. And if that happens, energy gets released by the atom, because it loses energy in that case. Okay? So this is why however many electrons are in an atom, they're in energy levels that are as close to the nucleus as possible without violating the maximum number of electrons that those shells can hold. All right? Does that all make sense? Well, then let's talk a little bit more about these shells. Remember, a shell or an energy level is itself just a subspace of the space around the nucleus. But that already subdivision of a space can then be further subdivided. So each shell is made up of what are called subshells, also just spaces. Okay? And then, in turn, each subshell within a shell already is further subdivided into spaces called orbitals. So this is all spaces, but it's a hierarchical arrangement. A shell contains a certain number of subshells. Each subshell contains a certain number of orbitals. All right? And orbitals are where you find electrons. Now, there are different kinds of orbitals, and they have different shapes, but keep in mind these are spaces, so the space itself has shape, this is not an object. All right? We're looking at five different orbitals here. Two of them are spherical. The one that's dark circle is one orbital by itself. The bigger circle is another orbital by itself. And then each of three dumbbell-shaped things, or infinity sign-shaped things, is one orbital of a different type, but there are three of those. You see all five there? Okay, now back to subshells. Since there are different kinds of orbitals with different shapes, we give those different names, different types of orbitals. The spherical ones are called S orbitals. These dumbbell-shaped ones are called P orbitals. And there are more than that in chemistry. That goes D is after P, and then there are Fs. But just about everything that happens important in biology involves only these two types of orbitals that we see here, which are S orbitals and P orbitals. The fact that there are different kinds, though, with different shapes, is why there are different subshells within shells. Okay, now every shell, meaning every energy level, which are numbered, 1, 2, 3, closest to farther away from the nucleus, every single shell has its own S orbital. And it has only one in each of those shells. It's made up of just a single S orbital. And that single S orbital makes up what we call the S subshell of that shell. All right? So the subshells are based on the kind of orbitals contained within the subshell. Okay? You following this? Okay, now every level has an S. The smallest circle is the S of the first energy shell. I mean, energy level or electron shell. The second one is the so-called 2S. The small one is the 1S because it's level 1. This bigger one is the 2S because it's the S orbital of the second shell. Okay? And the third one, even though it's not shown here, the third level has its own S orbital, an even bigger sphere. Every subshell that's labeled as an S subshell contains only S orbitals, but in the case of S, there's only one of them in each shell. So what we call the S subshell and the S orbital are really the same thing, because there's only one orbital in the S subshell. Starting with level 2 and above, but not 1, there are also P orbitals in addition to the S. Level 1 is made up of only one subshell, the S subshell, and that S subshell in level 1 is made up of only one S orbital. Okay, that's the small circle. Now, if you go farther away from the nucleus, you're in shell 2. Shell 2 has two different subshells, the S subshell and the P subshell. The S subshell is made up of only S orbitals, but there's only one S orbital in it. Okay, so that's the two s orbital that we see as the bigger circle. The p subshell of energy level 2 contains only p orbitals. But any shell that has a p subshell, that p subshell contains three different p orbitals, not just one. And they're all at right angles to each other, meaning they are mutually orthogonal. That's just another way of saying that they are all at right angles to each other, corresponding to x, y, and z on a three-dimensional graph. Right? They're all at right angles. And you see that right here. Well, it's a two-dimensional drawing, but it's supposed to be showing you that this is in one direction, this is in another, and the other one is coming out from the screen. All right? All three of those 2p orbitals, each one of them is a 2p because it's in the second shell, all three of them combine to make up the p subshell of energy level 2. And not shown here, if you go up another level to energy level 3, it will have its own p subshell, the 3p's. There will be three 3p's in that one as well. Okay, now does that thoroughly confuse you? It's all spaces, but what you need to realize is that there's every shell has an s. The first shell has an s, and that's it. The second shell has its own s, plus a p subshell that contains 3p orbitals. And then the third one would contain its own s subshell containing just one s orbital, its own p subshell containing 3p orbitals, and then it would also contain its own d subshell containing 5d orbitals. But we're not concerning ourselves with d's. I'm just showing you what the pattern is. Okay? Now the real reason in here that this is important is because whatever type of orbital you're talking about, s, p, d, f, it doesn't matter, any single orbital can contain at most 2 electrons, which means there are exactly 3 possibilities for a given orbital. 0 electrons are in it, it's empty. 1 electron is in it, or 2 electrons. 2 electrons are in a single orbital, that orbital is full. And therefore, any additional electrons that the atom has need to occupy some other orbital, which might be in a different shell or in a different subshell of the same shell. Okay? Now, think about what I said as far as the subshells are concerned. Level 1, shell 1, contains just one subshell, the S subshell, which contains just one orbital, the 1s orbital. That makes up the entire shell, that one orbital. And therefore, since any given orbital can contain at most 2 electrons, that means the entire level 1 can contain at most 2 electrons. Okay? Now this is going to be important in a minute, because having full subshells gives atoms especially high stability. Okay? Energy level 2 now, consider, which is everything except on this diagram except the small circle, which is level 1. It has how many orbitals? Shell 2. It has 4 overall orbitals arranged into 2 subshells, right? Energy level 2 has the S subshell, which contains the 2s orbital. And it also contains the p subshell, which contains 3 different p orbitals, which we would call the 2px, the 2py, and the 2pz. All right? That's a total of 4 orbitals for energy level 2, right? And each one individually can hold maximum of 2, which is why energy level 2 can hold a maximum of 8 electrons. And that's where the magic number 8 comes from in chemistry that you might have already learned about. When an atom fills that both of those subshells in that second level, it becomes very much stable compared to other things. And if we look at the periodic table, which, by the way, is arranged into columns and rows, but we don't use those terms. The rows of the periodic table are called periods, and the columns are called groups. Elements that are in the same group or column are chemically similar. And that's why it was arranged this way. The right edge, the group on the right edge of the periodic table, contains the so-called noble gases, which are inert. They're also called inert gases. Inert means that they do not interact with other things, including other atoms of their same type. That's because all of those have a filled subshell in their outer shell, and that makes them stable. So helium, which is the element number two, is stable because being helium means it has two protons, right? That's the only thing that matters for what kind of element it is. Two protons makes it helium. Since it's a neutral atom, it also has two electrons, so that it has overall no charge, right? Those two electrons completely fill up the 1s orbital, which is the entire first shell. So that is the stable situation that makes it not want to interact chemically with anything else, including other helium atoms. Okay, so it doesn't undergo chemistry under normal situations. The one right below it, which you see on the periodic table, is still on the right edge, has 10 overall protons. Okay, but that means it has 10 electrons as well to be neutral. Two of those 10 completely fill up level 1. That gives 8 additional electrons that you have to put somewhere. Well, they completely fill up the 2s and the 3 2p's, right? Each of which can hold 2. 4 times 2 is 8 in that second shell, and that's what gives it stability as well. So all of those ones on the right edge are like that. Everything else to the left of it, which is most elements, do not have this stability because their outer shell or subshell within that outer shell is not completely filled. And therefore, they can become more stable if they rearrange their electrons in such a way that their outer shell becomes filled. That's why chemistry happens. Chemistry does not really involve changes to atomic nuclei. The nuclei, protons and neutrons, are staying put. Chemistry is really involving just the electrons when two atoms come into contact. It's a rearrangement of those electrons in such a way that these outer subshells get filled up, making the whole thing more stable, like the noble gases are already. Okay? By the way, that outer shell, whichever one is farthest from the nucleus but still contains at least one electron, because we don't even bother to count them as shells if they're totally empty. But the farthest one from the nucleus, the highest shell that has at least one electron, is called the valence shell. Oh, I forgot that this is not supposed to be down. The valence, you have to be careful with this word valence, because it can be used in different ways. That outer shell that has one electron at least is called the valence shell. And that's important because when two atoms come into contact and might interact in a chemical reaction, it's not all of their electrons that are necessarily involved. The ones that actually meet when they touch are the valence electrons, the outermost ones. Those are the ones that are involved in chemistry. That's one use of the word. But we can also use the word valence to refer to a property of the atom. Okay? Well, actually, before I get to that, let me say a third way. We can also refer to the, however many there are, the electrons that are in the valence shell, not the ones closer, but the ones that are outer. Those are called valence electrons, simply because they're in the valence shell. But then we can talk about an atom's valence, and that's where it can kind of get confusing. The valence of an atom is how many additional electrons you would have to add to it in order to fill its valence shell or subshell. Okay? Now, practically, you can think of it as the valence, that is, as being how many steps away from that right edge something is. Notice, for instance, fluorine is just one step from neon. What that means, well, fluorine has, is, you might not be able to see it in the dark here, but fluorine is has atomic number 9. It has 9 protons, that's what makes it fluorine, but it has 9 electrons. 2 of them fill up shell 1, that leaves 7 more, right? The other 7 are in shell 2, in the s and the 3p orbitals, but it can hold 8, so there's room for one more. The valence of fluorine is therefore 1, because if you add just one more electron to it, it becomes stable, just like neon. Okay, that's the valence of an atom. So it's 2 or 8 minus the number of electrons in that outer valence shell, depending on which one it is. I say 2 or 8 because hydrogen, for instance, has a valence of 1. Because it has one electron and one more will fill it in that special case of the first period. Because 2 fills up that first shell, right? But the ones below it in the second and third, 8 is the magic number there. So the valence of fluorine is 1 because it has 7 valence electrons, 9 total, but 7 valence electrons, right? 8 minus 7 equals 1. It needs one more to become stable. Okay, let's go on then and make more sense of this. In slide 8, we see what I was trying to show you with my hands before, the three-dimensionality of the arrangement of the p orbitals. This is the 1s by itself. That makes up the entire shell. Second shell is made up of the 2s subshell and the 2p subshell. The 2s subshell is made up of just the 2s orbital. The 2p subshell is made up of 3 different p orbitals, 2px, 2py, and 2pz. Okay, so that's the basis of 8 being the important number. 2, 4, 6, 8 total electrons can be held in the second shell. 9. This is back to these cartoons of the planetary model that I've already told you is not really the truth, but it's useful to think about them. This isn't the complete periodic table, but this is the top part of the periodic table showing these shells, these circles, which are like planetary orbits. Those are not orbitals. You should actually be able to tell that they're not orbitals because these dots are electrons, and notice that some of these circles have more than 2 in them, so they can't be orbitals. Right, the circles represent shells, and that's why when you get to the second level, the second circle here, the right edge contains 8. You can't hold anymore. Then you have to go down to the third period, and sodium, just like on the full blown periodic table, sodium is the leftmost element in that third period. Okay, it's got 11 total electrons because it has 11 protons. 10 fill up the first and second, right? 2 for the first, 8 for the second, and therefore it only has 1 in that valence shell. Now, 1 is not its valence because valence doesn't mean the number of valence electrons. Valence means how many more you would have to it would take to fill it. So, sodium is an example of a metal, which most elements are. It's not a symmetrical left-right division, but things on the left side of the periodic table, all the way over to this pink stair step, everything below that and to the left, are metals. And metals have their valence shells more empty than full. Okay? So think about sodium. It has one valence electron. It needs 7 more to fill that outer shell, right? Or subshell. It could take on 7 electrons. But it's much easier to just lose the 1 that it has because, as I said before, if it's a totally empty shell, we don't even count it. If it loses 1, then it already has now its new valence shell full. It makes it just like neon if it loses that 1. Do you see that? And that's why metals do that. It's easier for metals to lose electrons to become stable than to gain them. The things that are to the right and up and above that stair step, which are much fewer in number, are the nonmetals. The nonmetals are close to that right edge, which means their valence shell is more full than empty. So it's easier for them to take on additional electrons to satisfy their valence than it is for them to lose that number of valence electrons they have. Which you can see with fluorine, like I mentioned before. Fluorine is just one step away from neon. So it could lose those seven to be just like helium, but it's much easier to gain one to become like neon. Okay? Now, there's another reason why it's important to distinguish between metals and nonmetals. Because if you have one of each, a metal and a nonmetal, they will react in such a way to form a certain kind of chemical bond called an ionic bond. We can see this happening in slide 10. First of all, an ionic bond is an example of a chemical bond, which not all bonds are chemical bonds, because when a chemical bond is formed, you no longer have the same substance. Sodium and chlorine are reacting here. It's the same reaction we looked at before. Those are two different substances originally, the reactants. When they react to form a chemical bond, you now have a compound which is a totally different substance, right? You no longer have chlorine or sodium, you have sodium chloride. Whereas we'll be discussing other kinds of bonds that can form that doesn't really change what you have, it doesn't change the substance. Okay, ionic bonds are chemical bonds, and they are the weakest of the chemical bonds. But they form between a metal and a nonmetal because of what I've already told you. Metals want to give up electrons in order to become stable, and nonmetals want to take on additional electrons to become stable. So they're a nice match, right? The metal will give up an electron or more than one, and the nonmetal will accept that electron or more than one. They'll both become stable, but notice that when this happens, when there is an actual loss of electron from one and a gain of an electron from another, you no longer have atoms, right? Neutral atoms. You now have ions. The metal atom, whatever it is, sodium in this example, by losing negative charge, by losing electrons, becomes a cation, a positively charged ion, right? Because it no longer has enough negatives to counteract the positives that are still in the nucleus. Just the opposite for the nonmetal. The nonmetal is taking on an electron. Chlorine is taking on one more electron here to become stable. And therefore, it now has one more negative charge than it has positive charges. That makes it overall a negative charged ion, which is an anion. Well, just the fact that there's stability with fullness of valence shells explains why these ions form. It doesn't tell you why they are actually held together. It just tells you why the ions form. The reason they're held together is because once you have those two ions and they're oppositely charged, they attract each other. Opposite electrostatic charges attract each other. So two sodium ions wouldn't fit together. They would repel each other, actually, because they're both positively charged. Same for two chloride ions. But when you have a positively charged cation and a negatively charged anion, they're going to stick together electrostatically. That's an ionic bond, so named for the fact that it's a bond between ions. Okay? That holds them together well enough for you to actually have different stuff. Sodium chloride, totally different properties from the things it's made of. But it's not, like I said, a particularly strong chemical bond. There's much stronger ones that we'll talk about. Slide 11 first, though, shows you a crystal of sodium chloride, which is just one salt. We tend to use the word salt in everyday language to mean specifically sodium chloride. But there's all kinds of different salts. Salt is just another name for an ionic compound. So it could be sodium chloride, it could be sodium fluoride, it could be potassium chloride. A metal and a nonmetal make an ionic compound, which can also be called a salt. Okay? Well, you might think that you have an idea what a molecule is, and you might think that there's such a thing as a molecule of salt, but that's not true. Molecules, you shouldn't use the word molecule when referring to an ionic compound. And that's because there is no specific size to a chunk of ionic compound. All right? It can be arbitrarily, it can be bigger than houses. You know, when you mine salt, you have crystals of salt that are bigger than houses. It's all one chunk. It's not made of molecules. Molecules is a word we use for a different kind of compound with different bonds, which we'll get to very soon. But when we look at this crystal, we can see it's made up of many sodium ions and many chloride ions, which were formed because of this transfer of electrons from the metal to the nonmetal. When the metal becomes a positively charged cation, it's positive in all directions. And similarly, the negative ions, the chlorides, are negative in all directions. So it's not just one sodium ion and one chloride ion that are attracted to each other. Each sodium ion is attracted to chloride ions in all directions around it. And similarly, for the chloride ions being attracted to all sodiums in all directions. That's why this chunk can be as big as you want. It just depends on how many total ions you have. It's all held together by ionic bonds, right? But it's all one piece. And so there is no limit to how big this can be, but there is a limit to how small it can be, right? The very smallest in this case would be just one sodium ion and one chloride ion. That would still be a salt, but it's not a molecule because it's an ionic bond. Instead, that smallest piece of a salt that you can have, or the smallest piece of an ionic compound, is called a formula unit. And the formula unit depends on the formula for the salt. Depends on how many atoms, or how many positive ions there are and how many negative ions there are. But as long as you have that ratio, right, the smallest number of particles that fulfills that formula is a formula unit. Okay? If you break apart a formula unit, you no longer have the salt. You have individual ions, which are totally different. All right, let's then look at the other major kind of chemical bond we'll talk about in this course, which is a covalent bond. Now notice valent, as in valence, refers to those valence electrons, right? Which is what's involved in chemistry, as I said. A chemical reaction is a rearrangement of valence electrons. Co means share. So covalent literally means sharing valence electrons. Sharing those outer electrons. Meaning two atoms share those. All right? Unlike an ionic bond, which forms because there is a transfer of electrons from the metal to the nonmetal, and the metal no longer has that electron, and the nonmetal does, full time, a sharing of electrons means that the electrons that are shared are going to spend some time around each of the two atomic nuclei. Kind of figurating around it, if you want to think about it in those terms. Okay? Now, importantly, this is kind of like a deal that's struck between the two atoms based on their valences. Here we have two hydrogens. A hydrogen atom is not satisfied. It's not as stable as it could be because it has a valence of one, right? It needs one additional electron to fill that first shell. By the way, the number, whatever we call the valence, which is the number of additional electrons it needs to have, you can also think of that as the number of bonds, covalent bonds, that it needs to make in order to become stable. So each hydrogen atom here is identical. Each one wants one more electron to become stable. So it's kind of like a deal that's struck between the two hydrogen atoms. Each one says, I will share my electron with you if you also share yours with me. And in that process, we'll both get credit for both electrons. Even though that pair of electrons is spending time around both, each atomic nucleus becomes stable because it's like having two to itself, only part-time. That make sense? Now, really importantly for covalent bonds, what we call a single covalent bond is made up of a pair of electrons. Okay? Each covalent bond is two electrons, one from each of the two involved elements, or atoms, but two total that are being shared. And that's why each of the atoms involved gets credit for one additional electron. Okay? They contribute one, but they get credit for the pair that's shared, so that's like getting an additional one. Even though we haven't added any electrons here, we're giving credit to two that are sharing it. So that's illustrated here by the merging of these probability spaces around the nucleus. The electrons are somewhere in this shaded area. They're going to spend some time around this hydrogen atom and some time around this hydrogen atom, so they both get credit. Well, that is what keeps them together. Not charge like it is in ionic bonds. This is a covalent bond, and the sharing of that pair of electrons is what keeps them together, and keeps them together much more tightly than an ionic bond. It's a much stronger chemical bond. And it's a chemical bond just like an ionic bond, because when this happens, you have a new type of particle. Now, in this case, it happens to still be hydrogen, but instead of it being a hydrogen atom, you now have a hydrogen molecule. So to properly use the word molecule, you apply that only to things that are made with covalent bonds, not ionic bonds. Okay? Yeah?
That's why the 2L is like A plus 2 is
2. Yes, and we'll use that as an example, I think, coming up in this, maybe this next slide. It's coming up still. It'll make sense, and then you're right about that. First, though, in slide 13, we can see two hydrogen atoms forming a hydrogen molecule, the same thing we just saw on the previous slide, only with symbols. When we use symbols, by the way, these are called Lewis dot diagrams or electron dot diagrams, we only care about the valence electrons. Now, in the case of hydrogen, it has only one total electron, so every electron happens to be shown here, but not for oxygen. Oxygen has 8 total electrons, right? Only 6 are shown here because the 2 that are already filled up its first shell, those are going to stay put. We don't bother putting dots for deeper electrons, only for valence electrons. So there are 6 shown for oxygen here. And remember, in that second shell, which is where these valence electrons are for oxygen, there are 4 total orbitals, right? An S and 3 different P's. That's why it can hold a total of 8. Well, they're paired up here. The dots are paired up to illustrate that they are filling an orbital. Each pair, this is filling an orbital, this is filling an orbital. This one is in one orbital, just half filling the orbital. And this one is in another orbital, just half filling that orbital. When you see these non-paired electrons, that means those are opportunities for more electrons to come in and fill those orbitals to satisfy the valence, making the atom a lot more stable. And so remember I said that the valence of oxygen can be thought of as the number of bonds that that type of atom is going to make. The valence of oxygen is 2, because 8 minus 6, 6 is the number of valence electrons for oxygen, equals 2. Well, oxygen makes 2 covalent bonds in any molecule it's involved in because of that. It needs to make a bond to satisfy this and this. So if you get 2 oxygens, each having this situation together, they will agree to share 2 pairs instead of just 1, so that each oxygen gets a credit for an additional 2 electrons, making it stable. That's a double covalent bond. It's really 2 bonds, but we call it a double covalent bond, and just like a single covalent bond features 2 electrons, 1 pair, a double covalent bond features 2 pairs, 4 overall shared electrons. And that's now not an atom of oxygen, that's a molecule of oxygen. Well, the same thing can happen when you get two atoms of different types together forming covalent bonds. But instead of forming an element, a molecule of an element, like you do here, you would be forming a covalent compound made up of two or more kinds of elements. Yeah.
So, in addition to that, what if another oxygen comes along on the other side?
Well,
it's empty.
This is a good. I'm glad you asked this because this brings back what I was talking about, the formula units. If two oxygen atoms do this, the whole thing is now satisfied. And there's not charge to it, so it's not attracting anything. And that's why a molecule is a fundamental piece. You can't make these as big as you want arbitrarily. It's complete when it's two oxygen atoms. And if you have another oxygen molecule come along, it's not going to interact with that oxygen molecule because the molecule by itself is satisfied. That's not true with ionic compounds because they're charged. These are not. Does that answer it?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go on and look at some compounds now in slide 14, including water, like you were saying. Hydrogen at the top. These are just different ways you can depict these things, different cartoons, basically. You'll often see these Lewis dot or structural diagrams, and you'll see these in the lab as well. You can draw a single covalent bond as two dots between the two symbols representing the atomic nuclei. And that's fine. But a shorthand version of that is just to replace that shared pair with one dash, which represents a single covalent bond. Now, the valence of hydrogen is 1 because 2 is the magic number for the first period, not 8, right? And that's why hydrogen only is able to form one bond. When there's many hydrogens in a big molecule, each individual hydrogen is making one bond with something else. Just like it does with another hydrogen to form a hydrogen molecule. So the valence is always going to be the number of bonds that kind of atom is making in a molecule. By the way, I didn't mention explicitly that covalent bonds are formed between two nonmetals. Ionic bonds are formed between a metal and a nonmetal. Covalent bonds are formed between two nonmetals. And I also didn't mention, which would be confusing otherwise, that hydrogen, even though it is on the extreme left side, it's the first element, it actually is a nonmetal, not a metal. So hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, those are nonmetals, and when they interact with each other to form covalent bonds, you get molecules. Water is shown here. This is the only one. No, there's two compounds here. Water and methane are both compounds, whereas these are elements. But look at water. Each hydrogen individually is forming one bond involving a pair of electrons, satisfying its valence, right? Oxygen is forming two overall single bonds, which is the same as making a double bond. It's satisfying its valence by forming two bonds. A single covalent bond counts as one bond. A double covalent bond counts as two. And you can even have a triple covalent bond, which are not shown here, but some things do this. That's the strongest covalent bond. It's the hardest thing to break of the covalent bonds. They're all much stronger than ionic bonds, even single covalent bonds. But doubles are stronger than singles. Triples are stronger than doubles. And, by the way, this brings up the specialness of carbon. Carbon underlies life. And all, actually more than just life, all of organic chemistry. Chemistry is a vast science, but you can kind of divide it into two major subdivisions of chemistry, organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. Organic chemistry is the chemistry of things that contain carbon. The reason carbon is so special is because of where it is on the periodic table. It has what is called tetravalence. Tetra simply means four. So it has a valence of four, right? It has four valence electrons, which is four away from eight. So the valence is also four, just by coincidence. But that means carbon is always going to form four bonds. The reason that's special is because it's more versatile than other valences. You can form four individual single bonds, like you see in methane. You can form two double bonds to add up to four. You can form a triple bond and a single bond to add up to four. And also, even if it's all single bonds, you can do that with four of the same thing, like all the hydrogens here in methane. It can be four different things, three of one thing and one of another. There's all kinds of possibilities, which is why there's effectively no limit to the number of organic compounds that can be produced, and we have already produced millions of different kinds that have never existed before. That's one part of the specialness. But, like I said before, things that are in the same group on the periodic table, same column, share properties. Carbon is not the only thing with a valence of four or with tetravalence. But what is special about carbon in that group it's a member of? Don't overthink this. If I asked this of a kindergartner, what would that kindergartner say is special about carbon in that column? It's at the top, yes. That's the correct answer. Meaning that it's the smallest, simplest atom that has tetravalence. And that's why we exist as carbon-based organisms. Okay? Let's go on to 15 now and talk a little bit more about water. We're looking at water, which is a covalent compound made up of molecules. That's kind of redundant. If you have a covalent compound, then you have molecules by definition, right? Because molecules involve covalent bonds. Well, in terms of chemical bonds, there's the dichotomy, two major types that we're talking about in here, ionic and covalent. But then you can subdivide the category covalent into two subcategories. And those are polar and nonpolar covalent bonds. Now, they're all covalent, both of these. So they're different from ionic. But what's different about polar and nonpolar? Well, polar means having different ends in some way, like the North Pole and the South Pole are different for various reasons. In the case of a polar covalent bond, what's different is the sharing of electrons. Now remember, we're talking about covalent bonds, even in the case of polar. So by definition, they're sharing of electrons, not a transfer from one atom to the other, right? It's sharing. But there's two different ways you can share things, equally and not equally. Okay? It's still sharing even if it's unfair, right? Even if one person hogs it for 6 days a week and gives you the car or whatever on Wednesdays, that's still sharing, but it's unequal, right? Well, it's electrons that are being shared here. If there's equal sharing, then there is symmetry, and therefore there isn't any polarity. There isn't one end that's different from the other. Okay? If there's unequal sharing, then the electron pair, the two electrons that are being shared, will be spending more time around one of the atoms than the other, by definition of being unequal sharing, right? And remember that electrons are negatively charged. So if there is unequal sharing, then the atomic nucleus around which the electrons that are being shared spend more time is going to make that end of the bond a little bit more negative. Right? Because electrons are negative. You have negativity where the electrons are found. Now, it's not a full charge like it is for an ion because the electrons don't stay there. They spend some time with the other atomic nucleus. But where they spend more time is going to make that end of the bond slightly negative. And the notation we use for slightly is the lowercase Greek delta, lowercase d in the Greek alphabet. Delta minus means slightly negative, not fully, not a negative 1 like an ion, somewhere below negative 1, or smaller magnitude, smaller absolute value than negative 1. Conversely, delta positive means slightly positive. Well, whatever the atom is that gets shortchanged in the deal, where the electrons don't spend as much time, that's going to make it slightly positive because you don't have those negatives there. Okay? And therefore, there's directionality to each bond. There's two such bonds in water. But if you're talking about a molecule, which by definition is made up of at least one covalent bond, in which the covalent bond or bonds is or are polar, then the overall molecule is called polar, or the compound itself. Water is a covalent compound, but it is specifically a polar covalent compound. Okay? And it's impossible to overstate the importance of this. None of us would exist, no life would exist, if it weren't for this fact. The fact that water is a polar molecule gives water a lot of special characteristics that have allowed life to evolve to begin with. And those are so important that they have their own chapter coming up, a whole chapter on the specialness of water. Yeah.
So I wouldn't be moving close to water
itself. No, that's just due to gravity, because the moon is a hell of a big chunk of rock compared to nothing on the other parts of the Earth. So it, by gravity, pulls on the water, and that bulges the ocean up toward the moon, imperceptible to us, but it's a lot of water. And then that's going to draw it in from the shore on that part of the world where it's not being pulled. It's going to go back toward the land and have a higher tide. Yeah, that's important, but for a totally different reason, unrelated reason. Okay, now consider the opposite of a polar covalent bond. A non-polar covalent bond is, of course, still polar. I mean, it's still covalent, meaning sharing. But it's an equal sharing, or very close to equal, at least. And therefore, there is no slightly positive or slightly negative charge. This brings up the question of why would there be unequal sharing? The reason for that is because of a characteristic of any given element. Each element has its own value for this, but the characteristic is called electronegativity. Electronegativity is a measure of how greedy, in a sense, an atom is, how much it wants those electrons for itself, how attractive it is for electrons. And the trend isn't perfect, but in the overall periodic table, values for electronegativity are low for elements in the lower left, and then they go up as you go toward the upper right, except for the noble gases. Exclude those. So electronegativity values get high as you go diagonally from lower left to upper right. And the highest one is fluorine. It has the highest electronegativity of all. Okay? Oxygen, though, is right next door, notice. So that means oxygen, with its very high electronegativity, wants those shared electrons to itself. Well, if you have two oxygen atoms to make an oxygen molecule, they're both equally greedy. They want them for themselves, but so does the other one. So they end up being identically shared. And that's why an oxygen molecule is nonpolar. It's equal sharing. Whenever you have two of the same kind of non-metal atoms covalently bonded, that's going to be nonpolar, because it's equal electronegativities. You can also have a nonpolar molecule if the atoms involved, even though they're different types, different elements, have, if not exactly equal, very close to being equal electronegativities. And this happens, for instance, when a carbon atom and a hydrogen atom covalently bond. Happens all the time in organic chemistry, including in your bodies. Carbon and hydrogen have roughly the same electronegativity. Therefore, they have equal sharing of electrons, and those bonds are nonpolar. So, compounds made up of just carbon and hydrogen, which there are many, those are nonpolar substances. Water, on the other hand, features oxygen and hydrogen, and oxygen's electronegativity is a lot higher than hydrogen's, or carbon's for that matter. But there's no carbon in this one. So that means the electrons are going to spend more time around the oxygen end of the bond. And that's going to make the oxygen part of this overall molecule slightly negative. And each hydrogen part is going to be slightly positive. The overall molecule is polar. Wouldn't make a big deal if you only had that one molecule. But that's never the case. You have trillions and trillions of water molecules, even in a tiny droplet. And when you get a bunch of them together, the fact that they all have these partial charges is going to give them more order, because they're going to swivel into place so that their opposite charges are next to each other and attract each other a little bit. Whereas in a population of nonpolar molecules, like a bunch of oxygen molecules in a box, they're going to bounce off each other, but they're not going to care. They're not going to be attracted to each other because they're all nonpolar. Okay? Well, we can see such an attraction in slide 16. In this case, in this example, it's not two water molecules, which would happen. Instead, it's a water molecule and another polar molecule. Water is not the only polar molecule. Ammonia also is. Nitrogen has a valence of 3, which should make sense to you because it's 3 notches away from the right edge of the periodic table. That means it's going to form 3 covalent bonds with another nonmetal. In this case, it's 3 individual single covalent bonds with hydrogen. Well, nitrogen also has a higher, significantly higher electronegativity than hydrogen. So the same thing happens for each of those bonds. They are all polar, and therefore the overall molecule is polar. And when these two things are in the same mixture, they will slightly attract each other. They'll swivel in such a way that the slightly positive part of one molecule will be situated next to the slightly negative part of the next molecule. It's a tiny attraction, but it's the same attraction that you have in ionic bonds, right? It's an attraction between opposite electrostatic charges. Not nearly as strong as an ionic bond, and that's why this, which is called a hydrogen bond, because it so often involves hydrogen, that's why this, a hydrogen bond, is not classified as a chemical bond. These are nowhere near permanent. They just form and then they'll be easily broken as things move by. But it's more than zero. It is an attraction. It's not a chemical bond, though, because not only because it's not permanent, but because it doesn't turn this whole collection into new stuff. You still have water and you still have ammonia, but they're just slightly attracting each other, kind of like little magnets. Yeah.
Is that why salt is soluble in water? Because the hydrogen bond wants to attract itself with the cations and anions of the salt?
That's right. In fact, we'll have a slide dedicated to that in this chapter we're getting to about the specialness of water. Yeah, the polarity of water is what accounts for the fact that it is such a good solvent for so many different things. It's not a good solvent, though, however, for things that are totally nonpolar, like oil. That's why oil does not mix well with water. Polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things, but they don't like to mix. That by itself explains why life is. I'll talk more about that later. 17 first. You might think when you look at water, which you see here in cartoon form, that it could be symmetrical. You know, you look at a carbon dioxide molecule. You have a carbon in the middle and 2 oxygens, which are diametrically opposed. They're on opposite sides. So it's a symmetrical in shape. Not so with water. Instead, you have this bent arrangement. You might think, well, why aren't the hydrogens as far apart as they can be from each other? The reason is that there are 4 orbitals in this shell, right? We've talked about this. And those orbitals represent the 4 corners of a tetrahedron, which for you gaming nerds is the 4-sided die. Those 4 corners are where electrons can be in those orbitals. And since electrons are all negatively charged, they should be placed as far apart from each other as possible. Well, in oxygen, its valence is 2, right? So remember how oxygen was drawn? It's O with 2 complete pairs, and then 1 half pair and another half pair. Well, these are the 4 corners of the tetrahedron. So 2 of those corners are occupied by these pairs of electrons that are fully the property of oxygen, that are always on that atom. The other two corners of the tetrahedron are the ones that are involved in bonds, and that's where you find the hydrogen atoms. So there are four corners. You just don't see the corners in the cartoon form that correspond to just the full orbitals of oxygen. See what I'm saying there? And that's why it explains this angle. It's the same angle that you have it in the four-sided die between those corners. Slide 18. Here we have a picture that's kind of a change in topics a little bit. You have a picture at the top of two cartoons of what qualify as signal molecules. Signal molecules are molecules, or I should more generally say signal particles, but they're usually molecules. Signals, though, the chemical signals, which are particles, obviously serve as a signal for something, meaning that they cause something to happen that wouldn't happen if they weren't there. Right? They're signaling something to happen. Chemical signals operate based on their shape. A really important thing to understand about a chemical signal is that it will have no effect. Nothing will happen in response to its presence unless and until that signal particle binds to another particle that has just the right shape to accept it. Kind of like a glove accepting a hand. Right, there's good fit between the two. And if there is a bonding that occurs between a signal and that other particle that we call the receptor, then something is going to happen in the cell that's different from what was happening before. Either something's going to start happening or something's going to stop happening because of the presence of that signal. So this is how your body controls other parts of the body. By sending signals, causing different things to happen. And those signals, if they're chemical signals, which means actual particles, then they operate based on binding to receptors. Okay? It's all based on shape, though. So, for instance, when I talked, I used oxytocin as an example in parturition, right? For positive feedback. Oxytocin is an example of a hormone. Hormones are examples of chemical signals. They're not the only kinds of chemical signals. Neurotransmitters are also chemical signals, for instance. But anyway, hormones are chemical signals. In the case of hormones, those signals get broadcast throughout the body because they're put into the bloodstream and the blood goes everywhere. But only specific parts of the body respond. Only specific parts of the body even know the oxytocin is there, namely the uterus. Because only those tissues have the correct receptors for that oxytocin signal to fit into. The others will be in the presence of oxytocin, but not even know it's there. Similarly, you can have a radio in here that has the correct antenna or receptor for the light, the radio waves, which are examples of light, passing through us all the time. There's radio waves coming through this room and through our bodies the whole time we're here. Right? But we're not responding. We don't even know it's happening because we don't have the receptors for it. Another important thing about this whole process is that when and if a signal particle binds to a receptor, then an important thing happens. There is a conformational change in the receptor. Now, conformation is just another word for shape. I said that shape is important. That's why receptors, there's all kinds of different receptors because they have to be specific to a certain signal. But receptors, no matter what kind they are proteins. And the receptor in this cartoon on the bottom is the purple part that's embedded in the membrane. So these receptors are not only receptors, they are membrane-bound receptors, not membrane-bounded. Remember I said there's a difference? These are not enclosed by their own membrane. They're part of a membrane, tied to a membrane, membrane-bound. But anyway, receptors are proteins. Now, a lot of signals, which are also particles, are proteins as well. They can be proteins, they don't have to be. But receptors are proteins in effectively all cases. And that makes sense for receptors to be proteins, because compared to the other three classes of biological macromolecules, lipids, polysaccharides, and nucleic acids, proteins can be arranged into limitless number of shapes. So if you were designing things, which is not how evolution works, but if you did it in a laboratory, you could make a protein be just about any shape you want. And therefore, it can be just the perfect shape for a specific kind of signal. Okay? So signals might or might not be proteins. The receptors that they have to bind to in order to have an effect are proteins. And the examples shown here of the signals are endorphin on the left and morphine on the right at the top. Now, these are different chemicals, obviously. You can see that from their overall structures. They are also, even though they're both signals, you can use different words to define them beyond just their specific names. Endorphin is an example of an endogenous signal. Endo means in. So an endogenous signal is a signal that occurs within the organism. The organism makes it. Right? We make endorphin as our own signal molecules. Morphine is exogenous, meaning created, like in Genesis, outside of the organism. Now, another word for an exogenous signal, since it's not something you make on your own, is a drug, which you probably already know morphine is classified as. They're both signals, though, because they both have their effects by binding to receptors on cells. Okay? Back to this binding event. I said if that binding occurs, then there is a conformational change in the receptor. The receptor is a protein. The shape of a protein is known as the conformation. If it changes shape, that is what actually allows the cell to realize something has happened. Okay? And that's what starts the ball rolling as to what is going to happen specifically in the cell. Look at the cell down here on the bottom. Something is going to happen inside this cell in response to endorphin coming by and binding, even though endorphin cannot get through the membrane. So the endorphin signal cannot enter the cell. Too big. In essence, it knocks on the door by binding to this endorphin receptor. But notice that the receptors... What's the verb here? Extends all the way through the thickness of the plasma membrane. So there's part of that receptor that's facing outside and part of it that's in contact with the interior of the cell. If you change the overall shape of the receptor, that means you're changing the shape of this interior part as well, even though that's not where the signal is. And that's going to get sensed, that's going to interact with things that are in the cell differently, because that shape has changed, and cause things inside the cell to happen in response to that endorphin that never enters the cell. Yeah?
Are receptors still like on a scale that's small enough that we can't see them?
Oh, yeah. This is tiny, 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 because that's an individual molecule of protein, and these are individual phospholipids, which there are many, many, many millions of them in just one invisible cell. So this is a very close-up view. Now, the reason that endorphin has a specific effect is because only a specific kind of receptor fits it, and therefore that causes a certain number of consequences. Okay? Morphine, on the other hand, can do the same thing, even though it's a totally different molecule. And that's because not the overall part of the signal matters, only part of it. Namely, the part that fits into the receptor site, that fits it well. So these are overall very different molecules, but notice that this part of it in the box for each one is the same, or almost exactly the same. And that's why this exogenous drug can mimic the effect of this endogenous, naturally occurring signal because it binds to the same receptors and changes the shape of the receptors in the same way that the endogenous signal does. Now, that is an example. Signal molecules binding to receptors is just a one specific example of the general case of something binding to a protein. Things that bind to proteins in various ways are called ligands. They're called that because ligate means tie or bind. That's why in surgery, a ligature is something that you tie. Yeah.
Now, how does morphine get accepted if it doesn't have one of the
Because all of the rest of the shape doesn't matter, just like it doesn't matter on endorphin. The only thing that matters is the part that fits in, and that's the same in morphine as it is in endorphin.
So can it go on the other one?
Yeah, oh yeah, this is just showing two receptors.
The natural endorphins, they go on...
Yeah, these could switch positions. This is the same kind of receptor. Either one of them could fit into either one. Because of this being the business end of the signal molecules, the part that fits in, that's the same in both. That's right. From the receptor's point of view, it doesn't know that it's morphine. It thinks it's endorphin and changes shape the same way it would if endorphin were binding instead of morphine. What was I saying right before that? Oh, yeah, ligands is a very general word. Means something that binds to a protein. And there's many examples of that. Signal molecules, or signal particles in general, binding to receptor proteins is just one example of a ligand binding to a protein. And I already told you that results in a conformational change in the protein, right? The receptor in this case. Well, there's all kinds of other examples of that. Another familiar example would be a substrate binding to an enzyme. Enzymes are proteins. So the substrates are the reactants in the reactions that bind to the enzymes in order to get sped up in their reaction. These substrates also qualify as ligands because they are binding to a protein, in this case an enzyme. It's just another example. But importantly, even though it's a totally different function, enzymes versus receptor molecules, it's still a ligand binding to a protein, and it still has the same consequence. If that binding of the ligand to the protein occurs, then the protein will change shape. And in the case of an enzyme, that causes the reaction to be accelerated. So, but that's in general the consequence of a ligand binding to a protein. There's a conformational change. Okay, I'll leave it at that for today, and I'll see you in the lab.